It is time for some very important legal advice, and the man who's best placed to do just that is William Cahir of Cahir & Co Solicitors, who joins me in studio. Good morning to you, William.
Morning, Alan.
Thanks very much for being with us. So last time you were in, William, we were talking about people buying or selling houses and so on. What about, though, someone who wants to build their own home, and does that present a lot more issues or difficulties or paperwork and all that?
I'm going to say it probably presents, from the person who wants to do it, they have a lot more work to do themselves. So from that point of view, they have a lot more research to do. They have to investigate, can they get planning? So are they from the area? What are the requirements of being from the area? What exactly is that definition? Can they get planning in the area where they want to build a house? And then can they afford to build the house that they want to build on that site? So a lot of more investigations beforehand need to be put in by the prospective, I suppose, builder or by the people who want to build on their own site.
Yeah, I guess there's so much you'd need to check out, you know, is there a water supply and, you know, all sorts of stuff in relation to it.
Yeah, and that's it. And you can look on Daft and you can look at all the auctioneer sites and they all have sites for sale. But the issue being is, do you qualify for that site? So therefore, are they sites that are designated, as we call it, under the local rules? And then there's a whole lot of progressive barstool advice, as I might call it, with regards to people getting planning. So I suppose people just need to be very cautious, and nobody wants to go down the route of signing a contract subject to planning and then wasting 12 or 16 weeks looking for planning on a site that ultimately they won't get planning on, or that's difficult to get planning on, and they've spent a lot of money.
Yeah, waste of time.
A waste of time and a waste of money. So a lot of, I'm going to say, pre-investigative work can really help people, and it just means they're more focused, and then they accept what sites are suitable for what they want to do. Because some people might want to do a really modern, architecturally designed house that might not be suitable for the site that they're looking at. Mm. And equally so, some people might just prefer a more traditionally designed house. And again, the council might prefer if it was more dynamic or if it was more architecturally designed to suit the area and the area of significance where you may or may not be building.
And I guess that's the key thing, isn't it? Your house has to kind of fit into the locality and what other houses look like. You can't build a 12-storey monstrosity if everyone else has bungalows.
Highly unlikely. I mean, ultimately the planner has the call on it, but it's really, you have to decide what you want to build, and therefore can you find a site that's suitable for that in a location that you qualify for planning permission, depending on your own circumstances.
Okay, William. So, look, at the risk of opening a Pandora's box here, and maybe it's a never-ending list of things people need to know, what do people need to look out for if they are looking to buy a site?
Okay, I suppose they need to look at, is the site big enough? So they need to have talked to an engineer with regards to, do they need a half acre or do they need 3/4 acre? Can they put a septic tank on the site, or do they connect? Is there a local sewerage system that they can connect into? And again, is the site covered under the zoning? So they can look up the county development plan and see what areas are zoned for development and other areas that are not zoned for development, but they might qualify under the local rules, so they could be from the neighbourhood, and there's certain other requirements that people can look at and see, look, would I be able to get planning on this site? And they can also have a meeting with a planner. You can arrange a pre-planning consultation with the council and discuss in broad terms, look, if I was looking at this, what do you think? You know, and you'll get a bit of a steer from the council in that regard.
Okay, those people, and I'm sure we all know them, who build a house and they say, oh yeah, I got the land from my dad or my, you know, whoever it might be, and you think, yeah, lucky so-and-so. But does that carry its own potential headaches, or what, you know, is the process much different for them?
Does,
if they get,
I suppose, it's not much different. I suppose people consider it's going to be a lot easier, but it can be a lot more emotive. So I suppose what we would always say is, make sure you've discussed all of the details with your family. So therefore, is the septic tank going to be on the site that you're getting? Make sure the site is big enough for what you want to do, so you're not coming back afterwards maybe to another sibling who might have inherited it, the farm subsequently, to say, by the way, can I have an extra 5 metres because I want to put a playhouse in?
Yeah.
You know, what type of boundary are you going to have from your site versus the farm where you might be taking the site out of? Are you going to have your own access? If it's going to be shared access, make sure you've set out the rules. Who's putting down the tarmac? Who's maintaining it into the future? Very simple things that if people discuss them in advance, there's never a row. But if you come to discuss these things in 20 years' time, when circumstances have changed and everybody's settled in, there can very often be a different discussion to be had. So,
can I ask you, William, if your parents donate you a site, even aside from, you know, having to fit into the look of the locality and all that, can the person or people who have donated you a site, can they legally say, well, we're giving this to you subject to you doing A, B and C? with whatever
yes.
you're building. Yeah,
yes, they can.
They have a legal right to say.
No. They have a right. It's a bit like hitting on a negotiation and a contract.
Okay.
So ultimately, it's a contract to say, look, you can have that site out in the main road on the basis that you do X, Y, and Z. And very often it can be sensitive because potentially if somebody has 3 acres on the main road, they might want to possibly get 6 sites in. And they're saying, oh, look, I really want an acre. I don't want half an acre.
Hmm.
You know, so the future development left and right of the site needs to be considered. Who might be building there? What's the future intentions? Is there 5 in the family? And are all 4 members getting a site along the road? Or are they going to try and hold on to it for grandkids? Or is that just going to be farmed and this will be the only site over this site? You know, so there are sorts of discussions that people have to have because I suppose people can be sensitive. People are married, there's children, there's lots of people involved. And therefore, it's the case of sort of know what's going to happen in the future with regards to whatever land is beside you. So at least you've had those discussions beforehand and it risks any type of falling out. They're very rare, falling out, but they can happen. So it's just really to make sure that those discussions are had.
God, there's a scenario for you. Imagine getting a site from your parents and then, you know, you have 3 or 4 of your siblings living alongside you as well. That's a family that needs to spread its wings a little further. Anyway, I'm just wondering, William, if somebody's building a house as opposed to buying a finished house or a second-hand house, in terms of the legal work, does that fill the in-tray considerably more?
Not initially, because the initial transfer of a site is very simple. It's a transfer. 99% of sites are land registry, so it's a transfer with a map properly marked out by an engineer. But as you're building, you need to make sure that you keep all of the subsequent paperwork. So the planning permission, your commencement notice, your receipts for any contributions, your engineering certificates are very important at the end, that you get all of those and you keep them because they form the basis of your future title. So I suppose the idea being if somebody's building, they need to be a lot more careful with their paperwork, whereas if they're buying a completed house, the paperwork comes straight from one solicitor to another solicitor.
Okay. And what stamp duty or taxes are payable if somebody buys the site?
Okay, so stamp duty on a site is considerably more than a house. So it's 7.5%. So if you're buying a site for 100,000, it's 7,500 euros that's payable in stamp duty. Now, you can recover some of that, but the reality is people have to be aware of the fact that that is the cost of buying a site. Whereas if you're buying a house, it's only 1%. So a lot of the time people are initially they're buying a site and they get quite a shock because they haven't factored in having to pay out the stamp duty initially for the purpose of purchasing the site. So people do need to be aware that land is considered commercial property and therefore it's taxed at the same rate as commercial property.
Okay, very important to know that. And sticking with stamp duty and taxes, what stamp duties or taxes are payable if somebody gets a gift of a site from their parents?
And similarly, so whenever anybody's giving away property, they have potentially capital gains tax on the site. Now, there is an exemption for parents if they're giving the site to a sibling, not to an in-law, to a sibling. So it's very important that the site goes across to the sibling in the first instance. And so long as a house is built on the site within 5 years, the parents have no capital gains tax.
Okay.
But the site does have to be valued by a professional auctioneer so that all of the various values can be properly recorded. There is stamp duty is payable on that valuation. So there is 7.5% payable if you're getting a site from your parents, but it's on the value of the site. Now, I suppose that has to be taken into consideration because the site could be considerably lower if you're qualifying under local rules. Mm. Therefore, it's not a site that could be sold to somebody. So generally speaking, the value of those sites is lower than what a site might be on the open market.
Okay. And can that stamp duty of 7.5% be payable on the purchase of a site? Can it be reclaimed at all?
It can actually, because it qualifies under, people might recall that there's a special exemption for if somebody develops land and builds houses on it, the government allows them to reclaim just over 2/3 of the stamp duty that they pay. It's aimed towards developers, but it also catches sites. So if you've paid stamp duty on a site, you can go and reclaim the stamp duty from that. So again, anybody who's built recently in the last 2 years, 3 years, should look at that and make sure that they have reclaimed their stamp duty. It's because it's something that can be overlooked. It's something that a lot of people weren't aware of.
Yeah, and you don't want to leave that behind you, that's for sure. Say, William, I'm the one selling a site. What are the things that I need to think of if I'm doing that?
The most important thing really is the boundaries, because a lot of the time we're surprised that when an auctioneer has a site sold, they haven't agreed who's putting up the boundary. What way is the boundary going to be done? Like, do you want to? Do you ultimately want whoever buys the site to put up a stone wall around it? Are you happy with just a post and rail fence? Or are they putting up hedging? Or maybe the person who buys the site decides they're putting up oak trees, which over time are going to create difficulties on the boundary. So it's just something that people want to consider. And equally so, they need to consider the amount of land frontage or the amount of frontage they have onto the road and how many sites longer term do they think they're going to get. Okay. So don't put the site right in the middle of your road frontage if potentially you could get three out of the one field. Don't lose that opportunity. So just plan it right.
Okay, proper planning. And what is building control and how do you register if you are self-building your own house?
Okay, so this was all the controversy that, as people will recall, the developments, I suppose, from the Celtic Tiger that went wrong with regards to fire safety and where we saw families being moved out of large developments. And ultimately, building control was reformed, whereas it's now called the BCAR system, which is the building control regulations and people have to register. But if you're self-building, there you can opt out of it. So you can opt to self-certify. And 90% of people who are self-building opt to self-certify because there can be a saving in relation to your engineering costs. But it's something that people need to consider. If I'm self-certifying, what am I signing myself out from? And what additional responsibilities am I now taking on myself? So therefore, if there's a problem with the house in 5 or 6 years' time, it's on your own head as opposed to being able to look at somebody who you've employed to supervise the house.
Okay, and sticking with self-building, is it more difficult or is it harder to get a mortgage for a self-build? And, you know, what documents is the owner going to have to get in that instance in order to register the house?
Yeah, this is, again, if somebody's self-building, they need to have told the bank that they're self-building. Again, very often people go in and say, look, I would love to get a mortgage of 350,000 euros. They put together all their paperwork and suddenly it's, oh, and by the way, I'm self-building. There is a different consideration because when you're self-building, you're not going to be drawing down all of your money in one go. You draw the money down if and when it's needed, which are called stage payments. Okay. You might have agreed with your builder, you'll pay him on 5 occasions as the house has been built. That means then you're drawing 70,000 to go from the bank. And the bank need to ensure that that's put into the special conditions of the mortgage. It feeds into the overall time frame of the mortgage. And so there is really the mainstream banks don't have any problem with self-building, but some of the other banks, which are more specific products for people who are buying houses, don't qualify. So people, again, if you're with a broker, make sure you've told the broker that it's a self-build that you're looking at so that when they're giving you the range of options, they've only included the banks that will do self-build.
Okay. And what about those who already have a mortgage but want to avail of a better interest rate by remortgaging?
Yeah, again, an awful lot of people ask, sure, why am I going to a solicitor? Wasn't I there when I got my mortgage originally? If you're remortgaging, you're effectively repledging your house to the bank. So the process is that the solicitor is asked to recertify the title to the house and to provide an undertaking to the bank, which means that I, as the solicitor, I'm personally liable to the bank for the money that they're giving to you if there's a problem with the house. So therefore, the solicitor has to go recertify all of the paperwork, represent an undertaking to the bank. So I suppose that is the purpose of a solicitor being involved. And ultimately, it's a 20, 30 year contract that you're entering into with the bank. So in the scheme of the size of the contract and the sums involved, the solicitor act probably has a really small part to play, but it might seem big at the start when I'm giving you a list of paperwork that I want from you.
So yeah, definitely a solicitor is definitely required in a remortgage, even if it's a they don't have a huge
only if you're changing bank. If you're staying with the same bank, they're not, generally speaking, they're not required. Okay. But if you're changing bank, they are. And in order to get the best interest rate, you normally have to be changing bank. But there's huge savings to moving your mortgage. And we're always surprised, I suppose, dealing with remortgages, that an awful lot more people don't remortgage and don't do it more frequently. I mean, I think everybody should be looking at their mortgage every 5 years, especially as the amounts reduce. So I can understand people initially, they try and borrow as much as they possibly can to get the best house they can. But after about 10 years' time, the amount you owe is reduced. Chances are you're earning a little bit more. You have a lot more flexibility with regards to the type of mortgage that you can get and the type of deal that you can get from a bank. So anybody who bought a house in the last 10 years should most definitely be looking at remortgaging, because an awful lot of them are on very high interest rates and there's much better deals in the market at the moment.
Do you think, William, perhaps one of the reasons why a lot more people don't remortgage their house is that the process of getting a mortgage, you know, can take time, and maybe some people found it a bit arduous and a headache, and then without really doing the homework, they maybe think, oh, you know, it'd be nice to remortgage the house, and they kind of think, God, geez, so much effort to get a mortgage in the first place. I couldn't even begin to deal with everything that comes. Whereas, as you say, actually, it would be worth their while. Okay, it might involve a bit of work and a lot of homework, but it'll help your pocket.
Yeah, no, and the issue, as you said, Alan, it's very difficult getting your first mortgage. As we might say, your next 10 mortgages are very easy. it's getting on the ladder the first time.
It's the first one that puts somebody off going to the second and third.
Yeah, which is really, really difficult. But I mean, at this point, you probably have 5, 6, 10 years of loan repayments made. Your salary is a bit better. There's equity in the house. You're not dealing with the issues that a first-time buyer is dealing with. Hmm. So it's well worth people going to a broker, looking at the range of options. And I mean, we recently had somebody who fixed for a very long term because they're now in their 50s and they just wanted security. They just want to acknowledge that with whatever happens the next 5 to 6 years in the world, they've got security and they know exactly what they're going to be paying. And the rate they fixed at was a lot cheaper than what they were already paying, which was very surprising. So it is well worth people looking at, and don't be put off just because solicitors are involved. Because if your house has been bought, the paperwork was dealt with. So therefore, this time around, everything should be in order. There'll be a few bits and pieces to be gotten, but by and large, it's just a process that takes a couple of weeks, and there can be very good long-term savings and security from the point of view of locking in or knowing exactly what you're going to be paying.
Okay, and maybe this is one where, you know, you take each case on its own merits, but generally speaking, remortgaging a house, is it a difficult process or easy enough?
Because I'm so involved in it, I would say no. A lot of people, again, it's like any financial product, people can be scared of them because they might not understand all the terms that are being used. Mm. But the reality is what you're doing is looking to reduce the amount of money that you're paying over a shorter period of time, which gives you a lot greater savings longer term and probably gives you more security and more certainty.
Okay, lots of brilliant advice there. Thank you very much, William, for joining us in studio.